coming to you live from inside the globe, perched high atop the Bugle Planet building in sunny Gotham City. It's Hey Kids Comics with two guys who are always ready to seduce the innocent, your hosts, Andrew Farmer and the Jedi Cole Houston. And now it's time for Hey Kids Comics.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Hey Kids Comics for our seminal 231st episode.
Finally hit the big 231.
Yeah, it's a big landmark, and if you're not familiar with podcasting, 231 is the one that everybody goes for. Very few make it. We've done it. So this is our big celebration. Tonight, you find us, if you've listened to the last episode, which if you have, the issue is all about the prehistoric times, the time before time, as Cole has coined it. You find us in the middle of a story
arc.
This
is period pieces.
Period.
Yes, the period pieces is our arc.
Yes. Yeah, and the whole...
Our last issue was the time before time, because we had dinosaurs and other prehistoric beasties as well as prehistoric characters, like our personal favorite now, Anthro, the Archie Andrews of prehistory.
Absolutely true. Absolutely true. But yeah, the whole point of this was to go and really take kind of a hard look and examine the psychology and the ethnobiology of why we keep going back to these certain time periods. There's deep wells in history that we keep going back to when we're talking comics and why they're so interesting, and maybe some character and storyline history there as well. So Cole, what is this issue that we're doing tonight?
This is, as we introduced last week at the end of the show, drawn like an Egyptian.
Damn it. Just never ends with you.
Yeah, so we're taking 2D, even 2D-er, in the form of hieroglyphs, giving you kind of putting in the mind of hieroglyphs and the like. And last week, of course, we had my impeccable co-host from the Rancor Pit, Eddie Medina, joining us. This week, we are equally honored, this is probably even more blessed. Sorry, Eddie. By as I described in my email to Andy today, I thought, let's see if we can get gentleman comic scholar.
Yes.
None other than Weldon Adams. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
When I imagine Weldon after that, I imagine him with the Murder on the Orient Express Kenneth Branagh mustache that he's sporting in the trailer for that, as well as like a big top hat and a monocle. So, Weldon, you gotta that's what I'm seeing when you talk.
Well, I don't want to ruin your image, but I did have a little trouble setting the ascot right before I picked up phone.
Hey, Weldon, we'll bring you back three issues from now. We're going to have a whole sub-episode on getting your ascot set right. It's something that I struggle with, too. So, and anybody who knows me knows...
You've got to get your ascot together.
Get your ascot together. Anybody who knows me knows that probably isn't far off from the truth. I have struggled with ascots more than once in my life. So... where do we want to start this, Cole? You're steering the trip.
This is the point, where you have to get off your asp.
Damn it. All day.
And delve into the ancient past. So we're going to start in that curious realm of ancient Egypt, because it's one of the most fascinating periods in world history. And it's one of those, I love the fact that there are periods in ancient history that seem to be defined by geography as well as the time period. I mean, who the hell cares what the rest of the world was doing, because the Egyptians won that epic.
Right.
That period where they were on top, nobody really cares what happened in the rest of the world. It was all just a bunch of BS.
All eyes were on the pyramid.
That's right. As well, they might be, And then later on, the Greeks came along and said, hey, have a little sugar for Greece.
Said, hey, you got some good ideas over there. Yeah. Be a shame if something happened to them.
That's right. Yeah, the Romans came in and they're like, hey, we're taking over, baby. We're like the Federation in that Piece of the Action episode. So, we're really going to look at ancient Egypt and comics. We're going to start there, and then we're going to move forward into what would have been contemporary at the time of any publication, and characters from their present coming into the past and visiting ancient Egypt. But Egypt is a good, it's like the fertile crescent of comic characters, because just so many characters got their start in ancient Egypt.
Yeah, a lot of my favorite characters got their start in ancient Egypt because a lot of my favorite characters are based in mysticism. So when you start looking at even a lot of, and I won't go into great detail, but even a lot of the errata for Doctor Strange is Egyptian based. Doctor Fate, the helm of, correct me if I'm wrong, is it, how do you pronounce it? I'm going to slaughter it. Is it Naboo? It's not Naboo. Is it Naboo?
It's been Naboo to me my whole life.
There you go. Yeah. So not only
did Jar Jar, George Lucas is like a ripoff.
Yeah. And also one of my favorite villains in all of DC, Black Adam, got his start at retroconned his start into Egypt.
That's so true. As Thoth Amon, is that right?
Thoth Amon, yeah. It was he was, and maybe Weldon can speak to this more than I can because there you go. I'm gonna step out of the way. No, because he got his start with the Greek pantheon, much like Shazam or Captain Marvel, I guess. But then at some point they flipped the script and made him and went all dogheads and snake staffs with him. Is that right?
They decided that he should predate the Greco-Roman gods, so they used Egyptian gods, and that's when his origin got moved to Egypt. Yes.
Fantastic.
Well, no wonder Greece was wanting some sugar.
Right. They took the best.
I may be mistaken, but I think his name all along was Teth Adam. Modern days, they called him Adam Teth.
That was his alter ego.
He may have had some kind of an Egyptian tag from the beginning, but definitely in more modern times, they played that up a lot more.
Right.
Yeah, there's another great DC character that has an Egyptian tie that is fairly obscure. And I love it because he's one of the only characters whose origin tracks straight back to Egypt, and yet he has no Egyptian styling in his costume, powers, or motif whatsoever. And that is, of course, Chris Mason, Metamorpho.
Yeah.
He got his power from the staff of Ra.
And he is definitely high on the list of Egyptian characters. That's an interesting point, though, because he is so decidedly, you know, the Egyptians didn't, like, put people into a quintet of of styling, you know, like he's the mud leg and the silver leg and the I'm not really sure what the scaly orange part. I guess he's like the goldfish section or something.
Yeah, I think so.
Hey,
or koi. You know,
you can get the best coconut ice.
Really,
what was that, Weldon? Yeah. Go ahead.
I was just going to say his character is very much the mug that kind of wandered into something, and so his origin is even that way. He was accidentally zapped with these powers and didn't bother to take on any of the paraphernalia, the refrain, the trappings that go with it. It's like, okay, so I'm this now.
Right. I'll put on a pair of putty colored shorts and that's good enough.
This is my life now. This is my life. Like, you are absolutely 110% correct. And he is one of my favorites because he is, we talk a lot on this show about the lost art of the gentleman scientist, the cavalier, archaeologist, archetype that has since fallen by the wayside. Unless you watch, the Librarians TV show on TNT, it's pretty much gone. And it's such an interesting, and it ties directly back into this topic because if you look at kind of that idea of, and I know this is going to be, I guess it kind of ties back to here, my absolute all time favorite comic book character, surpassing even one Hal Jordan, would be, Mark Spector Moon Knight.
And
he has an absolute direct line of sight to ancient Egypt in that, you know, he was a gentleman's mercenary that during his death throes stumbled upon a statue of now this has been rewritten many times now, and in the latest iteration, not only is he the avatar of vengeance, but he's also the protector of night travelers, which is, I think, is a really Khonshu. What was that, Weldon?
Yeah. I said, that sounds new.
Yeah, it is new. They're doing some really interesting things with the character now. If you haven't checked it out or if you've ever liked it, it might be interesting to pick it up in these latest iterations. But
I do want to point out that it actually, retcons are usually kind of irksome.
Yes.
But in this particular case, because isn't he like schizophrenic or something?
Well, they've embraced the idea that all of his personalities, all of his aliases, the Jake Crowley or the Jake Loxley, what was the rich one? There's Mark Spector, there's Jake Stephen Loxley. Graham. Yes, thank you. They're all just members of his dissociative identity disorder. So they've all been him all along, and what they've done is they've gone into different specific scenes with Crowley, kind of the his informant and later friend Crowley, where it's been Mark Spector. He looks like Mark Spector, but he's acting like Crowley, and he refuses to answer to anything Jake Loxley, and he refuses to answer to anything but Jake Loxley. So they're really...
It just sort of seems fitting that the origin changes, because you're probably just getting the origin as told through each of the personalities.
Yeah, yeah. And
that's an interesting way of looking at it. Yeah, it's just, you know, they're all perfectly valid as far as any given one of them knows.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. That Loxley creep's just full of it.
So, yeah, that direct line of sight to ancient Egypt and absolutely one of his favorites.
Another very long-lived character in various incarnations is Hawkman, whose origins also, I mean, he got his start in ancient Egypt. If all had gone to plan, he would have died, been mummified, and who knows, maybe have been firewood for North African trains back in the early days of archaeology, when there were so damned many mummies being unearthed that they just burned them for fuel in locomotives.
You called me before the show and we were talking, and that in my 40 years of life, college educated, read constantly life, National Geographic owning, subscription owning life. That is the first I have ever heard of this. So is this – explain this a little bit, either or both of you, if you can, because I'm really curious. I know it doesn't have anything to do with comic books, but it does tie directly back. So,
Weldon, do you have a personal familiarity with this strange phenomenon of the past?
I heard of it, but I don't have any real scholarly insight on it.
Yeah, you're talking about like the 19th century, and mm-hmm. You know, I think every museum – carnival sideshow, and anyone who was at all interested was gifted an Egyptian mummy. and they still had an abundance. They were just like yanking these things out of the ground to make room for for future buildings in Cairo, where all the television antennas would have to be taken down for Raiders of the Lost Ark. So it's strange how history works that way, but it does. But no, literally, there were so many. The mummification process, we associate very heavily with, you know, the ruling class, with the various dynasties. But mummification was pretty much the standard. You know, you just probably got low-rent mummification. So you have like all these corpses laying around that nobody wants, because most of them don't come with really cool gold inlay and filigree and hieroglyphs and cool stuff and treasure chambers. Most of them just, maybe if they're lucky, came with a dead cat. And so they just literally burned these human remains as fuel to get the railroad going. Because, I mean, frankly, Egypt's not really heavy with wood and coal, so they had something to burn there.
I imagine,
in those days, if you're going to have a barbecue, if you're like a Brit living abroad in there and you wanted to have your friends over, you might just like go pick up a mummy and crumble it into the barbecue pit. It was like Lord Kingsford came up with that.
That you do bring up a good point, that the plundering of Egypt, I think, actually plays directly into why a lot of these heroes come from Egypt.
It
was so common in the late 1800s that often people of the aristocracy would go overseas and go to Egypt and come home with a mummy and have a mummy unwrapping party and invite all their friends over. And they would unwrap the mummy there in someone's living room.
I guess when the ether parties got too pedestrian for them.
Right. Yeah. That's the original unboxing video.
Gentlemen explorers and, you know, scientists were going over and just carting stuff back. They were plundering Egypt. So that's one of the reasons that there are so many hero origins that are essentially, well, I went to Egypt and I dug up this magic thing and I took it home.
That's right.
I'm criminals in the face with it.
That's right. I didn't even consult the authorities. I just took it back on the Pan Am flight. Checked baggage.
Pan Am.
Oh, an orb of Ra.
They were probably running Pan Am in 1875, too, so you're fine.
Yeah, it was a little different. Yeah. You know, it was Pan Am rail line, but you get the idea.
No, but so that brings me to an interesting point. I do want to talk about Asterix, the French comic, a little bit. I guess it's more Belgian than French, but, you know, seen one, seen them all. I'm going to offend all of our Belgian viewers or listeners.
Oh, there we go.
That one guy who tunes in once every 6 months. You're gonna hate us now. But I was talking to Cole before the show. What really interests me about this time period, and as we go forward and start thinking about this, is the idea that, and maybe Weldon can shed some light on this for me, because I'm really looking for a reasoning to this. I think I kind of have my head around it. One of the reasons I think it's so popular to see all these characters sort of with, when we start talking about Apocalypse, or we start talking about Vandal Savage had his real gold medal moment during this time period. When we start talking about like Metamorpho, we talked about Moon Knight, and we're going to keep talking. We got a ton of them to talk about, whether it be mummies time traveling time pharaohs that like to fight themselves at different points in the future. the intersection of unknown mysticism and pseudo science that we live in when we talk about a fictional ancient Egypt, I think it really plays into the idea that this is a really popular, fun time period to explore in a fictional setting because of that, because we don't have a lot of, and maybe you can correct me on this, like puerile, like real written records. We have pictographical records, we have hieroglyphic records, but when we look at those as a layman, we see dog-headed man being, being dragged on a flying cart by 10,000 slaves who are going to their giant golden pyramid, and immediately we're like, that's superhero stuff, right? Like, that has to be. So, I mean, does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. Well, no, because I think the pantheons of the ancients, this is the Egyptian is the oldest pantheon that got introduced to the general public.
Okay.
I mean, concurrent New World pantheons will never be as well known because, like Weldon was saying, people are going over to Egypt routinely because you can literally drive from Europe to North Africa.
Right, right.
Or, I guess hop a train or a boat. So, Europeans going to the northern part of Africa, Egypt is ideally situated for Western plunder and for bringing back the mysteries of, and in many ways, the hieroglyphs, sections of temples and such become like the fossil record of that period in the way that, shales falling off. Oh, looky, an ichthyosaurus worked for our previous episode. So here you have this wonderful period that's fascinating because it's like it predates the Greeks. It has just as interesting, if not a more interesting, pantheon because you have that mingling, that anthropomorphization or I forget the term where you're literally combining parts where the Greeks got closest with the Minotaur.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, Weldon. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I was just going to agree that the gods of ancient Egypt very easily translate to the iconographic image of what we see as superheroes now, more so than some of the others. But they were larger than life. They had animal heads a lot of the time that we associate as masks. And, it fit the look for what we were looking for. But one of the other things that I think is important to remember is secret societies.
Uh-huh.
Almost any secret society worth its salt will guaranteed claim that its history goes directly back to the secrets of the ancient Egypt world. And
that's a very good point.
Yeah, secret societies. They almost every single one, they all track right straight back there. So there's been this long, long fascination with mysticism of ancient Egypt. And so it's only natural that someone takes that and just pushes it over that little speed bump, and now you've got superheroes.
Well said. Well said.
Absolutely. And also, if you look at the transition in your Hawkmans from the Golden Age, where you have the more traditional hood, you know, with or masks and such, and you go into the modern one where you're almost, it's an invocation of Ra and Horus in a way, right, with that curious little beak right where your mouth should be.
Well, Kingdom Come. Look at Hawkman from Kingdom. That is absolutely Horus. There is no question about that being Horus at all.
At that point, I guess implicit story there is that he ultimately becomes, you know, like literally becomes the ultimate incarnation of the gods that he worshipped in his first life, before apparently being cursed to constantly be resurrected or reborn, and really have a hard time keeping straight the whole story of, you know, after five centuries exactly.
I can't remember if that character was actually Hawkman or if that was not Northwind. But I definitely do see to your point there.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it was Northwind.
It was already Hepburn.
Right.
Yeah, Northwind already had the funky face. He was kind of like Hawk from that late season of Buck Rogers.
Damn, right. That's fantastic.
Who inspired Bird Person on Rick and Morty for those kids who don't realize there's some backstory there in a way. But what's fascinating about Hawkman is he's one of those characters that fits perfectly into the opening of this story or this narrative, is he starts in Egypt, in the ancient Egypt, and then works his way forward and eventually winds up in America, but at least the original incarnations, before he came from outer space. And then you have another interesting character, like on the Marvel side of the field. Speaking of mummies, one that did get torched.
Yeah.
Was none other than Marvel's own living mummy.
The living mummy. They had a living mummy and a living vampire, you know.
They do. And a weird zombie. They've got it all. They've got it.
It's like I'm taking what they're given because I'm living for a living.
I don't like you very much right now, Cole. I'm just...
I know. I have been plying poor Andy with ridiculous song notions all afternoon.
He has. We'll get into one later. Just awful.
Encanto, the Living Mummy.
Encanto has been kicking around for a really long time, up to even currently, like today. As one of the new Howling Commandos that they have created that Phil Coulson puts
together.
It's
essentially DC's Creature Commandos, but that's cool.
You're not wrong. You're absolutely right.
But it does occur to me, I would really love to see a story where you have some like serious one percenters get somebody to capture Encanto and attempt an unwrapping party.
the Hellfire Club.
There you go.
That would be who it was.
That would be absolutely wonderfully brilliant turn of there.
Why are mummies scary? We've got a new mummy movie coming out with old Tommy Cruise in it. As part of this dark universe, I guess shared universe that they're making with the Universal monsters. For me, mummies are the least scary. But here's a question, though. Now that I'm actually kicking this around, and Weldon probably hit the nail on the head, is mummies are scary, partially probably because we found these things in these giant cairns without thinking, without context, threw them in the back of a wagon and drove them back to London and started having unwrapping parties in our living rooms. People probably end up getting sick or something like that, and all of a sudden mummies became scary. Does that sound like a fairly accurate point by point on that, or was there something I'm missing on why mummies are scary?
I don't know if that's a factual thing, but it sounds good.
welcome to Hankins Comics.
Exactly. We don't worry ourselves with facts here.
We live in a post-factual society.
That's right. We don't stand on ceremony or actuality here at Hankins Comics.
I never realized how well we played into the up-and-coming society.
I just don't understand. That's one of those things that I've never gotten, is why... Why mummies are supposed to be scary? Because there's mummies all over comics.
As a child, I often wondered about that. I would watch the old black and white movies, and the girl is screaming and screaming as the mummy comes shuffling closer and closer, and I kept thinking, you know, you could have made it to the door back three times by now if you'd have just moved.
Yeah, you could seriously be like counting coup all day because they're shambling. But I think perhaps the fear element in a mummy is the idea of this sort of nonchalant attitude toward human corpses.
Okay.
To the point where, you know, you're literally just like taking human remains, you know, in the distant past and shoving them into the coal fire without even thinking twice about the fact that that's a human being. And I think that there's somewhere in the subconscious this realization that this is a corpse, a really, really, really old corpse.
Yeah.
And I think therein, because the mummy is just like the tamest, most, you know, you take it home and put it in a little cabinet next to the grandfather clock or, you know, put it under the grand staircase to frighten the children if they got curious what was behind the door number three. But, there was a sort of societal attitude about mummies as being the harmless dead. They're so well preserved, you can just kind of prop them up. I mean, this is going to sound creepy and weird, but as kids, every now and again, we'd find these naturally mummified toads that would die and sort of dry out in the sun.
We are in Texas.
That was kind of a cool little thing to find. And, you'd keep it around the house for a few days, and you get tired of it and chuck it, or use it to run your toy locomotive, depending on. But I mean, you know, that literally it was something that you could have and keep, and then for that to suddenly become animate, that's not supposed to be that way.
And basically any museum of its salt, any museum of history and antiquities had a mummy.
In
the late 1800s, it was not totally impossible for the average person to maybe not go see one, but at least know that, there's a mummy in this city. There's a mummy here, you know. I mentioned secret societies earlier. Here's a little factoid for you. Do you know where the largest collection of mummies in the world outside of Egypt is?
No, I have no idea.
It is in
Disney's vault.
The Rosicrucian Museum in California.
The Rosicrucians. Those damn Rosicrucians.
The Rosicrucian Secret Society has the largest collection of Egyptian mummies in the world outside of Egypt.
You know why? They didn't own a train.
They were buying them up and nobody was paying attention.
Well, that and they didn't own a train.
Right.
Right. They're just stacking up.
That's right.
Also, I think there's a thing about mummies that plays into this. I'm saying this in reverse, understand that, but somewhere along the line, the mythology came into being, and it was probably in ancient Egypt when I imagine, and again, I'm extrapolating, but when you got a bunch of dead rich people buried all around your town with all their stuff, you need a wives' tale to keep either children or ne'er-do-wells from going in there and stealing all of that and grave robbing. So you start spreading this rumor that if you break the seal, you enact the curse of that particular mummy, and that mummy will stalk you and kill you, thus becoming what I would consider, and again, I'm going to say this in reverse, right, the original Terminator. This unstoppable killing machine that almost a Michael Myers type thing where nothing you're going to do is going to be able to stop it. It's going to keep coming until you're dead. So why don't you leave that golden cat statue alone and go back to bed? You know, that's I kind of get that idea too. We've just kind of outgrown that because we live in a world where, you know, we have nuclear bombs and, you know, movies about the Babadook. So.
Interesting. You mentioned something there that is really very fascinating to me. Almost every culture in the world has at least some kind of myth about the dead coming back to life. And they do become like this unstoppable engine. For example, China, they have the hopping vampires. I forget where the stories of the ghouls came from, but I think it was like the Balkans area of Europe.
Right. I think you're right.
Yeah, and then of course you've got, you know, the Zvimbi, the zombies, you know. This is a common thing, but only in Egypt are these undead returned to life rich.
So true. And a lot of them have bling.
Right, you think they'd just be happy. You think they'd just be happy where they were. Now, so
let's talk a bit about. I'm sorry. Go ahead and finish because I think this is an ideal time to sort of flip the script and head the opposite direction where we're going back.
Yeah, that's where I was going. So why don't you take us back in time?
Yeah, because this is the point where, you know, that we talked on the last episode or on the last issue about how we still to this day embrace this sort of Victorian fascination with the ancient world or the prehistoric world in the case of the last one. And I think we still have never shaken that Victorian fascination with ancient Egypt, and by certainly, as Wilson pointed out, secret societies being just Khufu for Cocoa Puffs when it comes to...
I know you've been holding on to that one for about 4 days.
I have been holding on to that one. So you start your modern comic writer when they're not like looking to have things take place in ancient Egypt or have their origins there. They want to go back. That's an interesting stopping point. If you're time traveling, it's like Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. You don't just stop. You don't just stay in one place and time travel. You wind up time and space traveling because you want to go where the cool kids are. And the cool kids in that period in history, the beginnings of history, literally, were in Egypt. And where does
it's
that
like a ready-made set, you know? Yeah. It's got all the grandeur and splendor and, you know, just it had everything you could need to hang a story on. It was there.
Absolutely. And that brings you some fascinating stories, some bizarre-ass stories. You know, oftentimes Egypt sort of crowbarred into the mix. In researching the show and trying to find some flavor art, as a matter of fact, I stumbled on Batman and the Outsiders number 17, where apparently Bats and the gang all go back to ancient Egypt to go confront Metamorpho.
Right.
Yeah, that book was always kind of squeaky.
Right. There wasn't that Art Adams book where Neil, right? Where he was just like, screw you guys, I'm going to make my own Batman book and make it as weird as humanly possible. Just...
I don't think that was Neil. Like, that was Batman and the Outsiders. I can't remember who wrote that.
It was Mike Barr. It was Aparo and Barr.
Yeah,
that's
it was.
Right.
It was. Yeah, you're right.
Because at some point,
it was a weird book.
Yeah, basically there's a scene of a scribe or something revealing, I guess, to Pharaoh, because he's certainly dressed a bit like Rama Tut from the Rama Tut collection. and like in all modern tellings of ancient Egypt, apparently Pharaoh never put down the crook and the flail.
Oh, yeah.
It's like they just had
back with something.
I guess so. But you'd think they'd have people for that, but apparently just never put them down. So he's like always walking around with them. And, but this scribe here reveals this either piece of rock formation or something, but in which are inscribed in profile imagery of the Outsiders.
Oh, really?
Right down to, like, was it GeoForce's, coiffure out type hood, and that pixie cut that Katana used to sport before she started trying to be like 90s sci-fi martial arts comics. And even the high collar for Black Bolt, or not Black Bolt, Black Lightning.
Black Lightning, yeah.
Anybody got anything to say about a Golden Pharaoh from the Superpowers line?
I am only familiar with Golden Pharaoh from the Superpowers action figures. I know that they did try to sort of bring in all of those characters that were created for the Superpowers cartoon into canon.
They did. They tried. Try being the operative
they did
term.
Try. Yeah.
I don't think there's anything really to talk about there. I just wanted to make sure that Golden Pharaoh got brought up on this episode of this show.
Totally fair. Totally fair. And since we're going to do that, I'm going to throw in a Marvel one that gets overlooked a lot. In the 70s, Marvel started a new book called Nova, the Human Rocket. And one of his recurring bad guys was the Sphinx.
Oh, I
remember the Sphinx, yes.
So you were alive in the times of ancient Egypt. You come back to life somehow in modern-day New York City in the 70s, and you got nothing better to do than to fight this punk-ass kid? Come on!
I think that happens when you have severe culture shock born of thousands of years of development. And,
absolutely.
Like, you know, he should have had other goals.
Yeah, he probably could have achieved a lot of things, but he just got, you know, the ancients were rather single-minded, I guess.
So here's your quick rundown. Ashley Halberstam. Halberstam is the Golden Pharaoh's real name. British Egyptologist. While on an expedition in Giza, he was struck by a bolt of energy emanating from the new gods. Just out of them, you know, just coming out somewhere.
Well, they were on holiday touring Egypt.
Right. The bolt awakened his latent superpowers, calling himself the Golden Pharaoh, not the Golden Brit, you know, not the Golden Welshman. He was the Golden Pharaoh, because you have to name yourself after the place where the bolt hits you. That's the reason, right?
Yeah.
He became a superhero. So that's your one-line elevator speech origin story for
That fills in blanks that I never really cared to explore. But nonetheless, I'm happy to have that out of the way.
I have to wonder if in comic books, the people that lived in Egypt in the comic books,
right,
the Egyptian national citizens, did they ever get mad that none of them ever got powers? It was always some freaking foreigner showing up.
That's right.
Yeah, that's a good point, because the only Egyptian that ever got superpowers was born 5 centuries earlier, and we would be very remiss in the direction we were originally taking to forget, as much as I would love to forget, none other than Apocalypse.
Old Apocalypse.
I knew you were going to bring him up.
Well, Apocalypse, one of the main reasons I want to bring him up, Andy knows this only too well. I take tremendous issue with Prince Namor of Atlantis being the first mutant. Yet, wasn't Apocalypse, by chronology, born 5,217 years and 26 days and 15 minutes before?
Yes, you are correct.
You know,
Namor?
You give them enough time, and someone's going to write a story that proves that Wolverine's older than that.
Wolverine, like any good secret society, can trace his way all the way back to Abu Simbel.
That's right.
Imhotep first invented bone claws.
That was the secondary mutation, right?
Isn't anything.
So what they did was they went back, because you had Apocalypse, always had like a vaguely, I'll be honest, the ascribations of early Apocalypse, the visualization was really cool to me. Like, I don't know why, but the weird face, you know, and the big bodysuit, like, I was like, all right, I'm a 15-year-old kid or a 14-year-old kid. This is working for me. Like,
yeah,
this
see,
is hitting
for you,
the
it's
sweet
forgivable
spot.
To like him.
Because I'm 10 years younger than you? Is that why?
Yes, exactly.
But then you go into, when was it? was it 96 when Rise of Apocalypse came along, in that 90s, everything is hyper accentuated. Apocalypse has, you know, muscles that don't exist unless you're Apocalypse. And you get a 4-issue miniseries where they really go in.
He has quadceps. He has, like, quinceps and sexceps.
We go back to...
not to mention the LaField seps.
Yeah, he does. He does. But you go back to when he was a baby in Egypt, and they spend 4 issues, which I think I still own somewhere in this house, this comic book, this miniseries somewhere, explaining how he becomes Apocalypse. And it's just, it's bizarre. It's nothing that was ever explained prior. Nothing was like a callback to anything that we had seen before, really, besides the fact that we knew that, I guess, vaguely that he was of Egyptian descent, other than that. And the fact that during the time that Apocalypse Rises, it was ruled by none other than Rama Tut.
Oh, that's so cool.
Oh, Rama Tut.
Yeah, in fact, Rama Tut, I think... is sort of the poster child for visiting ancient Egypt as a time traveler.
Yeah.
Oh, he's more than the poster child. He's the booster gold of visiting ancient Egypt.
Yeah. Yeah. Why just visit the past when you can rule it?
Not only rule it, but be the only person in the in that time period who was packing heat. And nobody wondered about that. Nobody even bothered to chronicle that in the ancients.
So can someone, maybe Weldon, maybe Cole, or maybe the combination of you both, just explain to me the dynamic, or I guess the chronology between Rama Tut and Kang the Conqueror? Because they're the same person.
Oh, yeah.
But they're not, because at some point they fight each other in the future. Yeah. So what's happening there? Because he does not only travel back in time and rule, but also exists in the future and fights himself somewhere in between, and just it's a mess.
Yeah. Kang comes first.
Then
Kang the
marriage.
Conqueror, he travels through time. He gets afoul of the Avengers, and he becomes fixated on them, and he fights them throughout history. And at some point, he hits his head so hard.
No.
Are you kidding me? I was going to joke about a head injury.
No. Weldon, are you kidding? Please.
I'm not really sure. There's a little conjecture here. But the point is, at one point, he realizes, hey, this is stupid and pointless. I never win. I'm just going to go retire. And he goes back to Egypt and adopts a completely new identity and becomes Rama Tut. And lo and behold, the Fantastic Four and the Avengers keep showing up.
But it turns out that a lot of Reed Richards' devices run off mummies. So he has to keep going
dark
back
secret.
In time. He has to get there before the Victorians
up.
Do and load up.
His
they
ultimate
nullifier.
They keep finding all those empty tombs.
Yeah, they thought they found a crap ton of mummies that they couldn't give away.
It's the name of my next band.
Man, Richards took back 10 times what they ever exported.
Yeah.
It's right. In a weird suppository-shaped flying car that nobody understood.
Yeah. Yeah, the pogo plane would show up, and they just, load them up, boys! Bring out your dad!
Well, I'll make a deal with you.
That's, of course, when Johnny and Ben weren't busy being the red-headed Beatles of 10,000 BC.
Oh, that's so true.
No, wait, that was Jimmy Olsen.
That was Jimmy
Why
Olsen.
Didn't those guys ever meet in Egypt? Think how much fun Johnny and Ben and Jimmy Olsen would have had in Egypt.
I just want to see a Sumerian pickup band with Jimmy Olsen and Rick Jones. And Snapper. Maybe Snapper Carr can play tambourine.
Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man. But, you know, the thing about Rama Tut and Kang and Immortus, even, I kind of looked at that as like maybe you were traveling around time so much that you actually might lap yourself.
Yeah.
That, you know, you get a good head of steam going there. Next thing you know, you're like, what, was that me? Seriously, did I dress in, like, Egyptian battle shorts and a screwy hat?
Egyptian battle shorts. It's fantastic.
Like, no wonder I was carrying a gun. I had to, otherwise it's completely most emasculating costume ever.
Right. Yeah, you got to have a large, large gun to go with a skirt like that.
Exactly. So yeah, Ramatut's an interesting character because I love looking for when I was looking for some imagery for this show, I found there was a page in a Fantastic Four that they used to have character profiles in mm-hmm. some of the old Marvel comics, and there's a wonderful write up which will be included in some of the flavor art that tells all about Ramatut, and there's even potential connection to Doctor Doom.
Oh yeah,
Who wasn't Ramatut?
Well, I'll tell you who he was also was when he joined the New Avengers as Iron Lad, later to be revealed as Kang the Conqueror / Ramatut / Nathaniel Franklin, or Nathaniel Richards, I'm sorry. He became, when he was unmasked as Kid, or Iron Lad, he became Kid Immortus, because nothing is more creepy.
Oh, right.
Well, here's with apologies to Stan Lee.
Never apologize.
Can
to
figure
Stan
out
Lee.
Old Rom, or if you can figure old Rom out, you're better than we are. He came from the future, landed in the past, and claimed to be a descendant of Doc Doom.
Well, wasn't he a descendant of Doc Doom? Because wasn't he some kind of weird Richards tie-in back to the Richards family? I don't even know.
It easily could have been a love child of Dr. Doom and Sue Richards, because at intervals Sue has, if she hasn't bedded nearly everyone in the Marvel Universe, they've all at least made a play for her.
Well, wasn't that our Namor joke?
It's like, Tony Stark comes flying, and he's like, oh, who are you? I'm John Cogtostoy.
That Reed is so disconnected from Sue's life that this never-ending string of superheroes is coming over to the house.
Pregnancies that she artfully disguises with invisibility. I had Catherine in stitches one time just talking about that period where the first family of superheroes there was a period under John Byrne where they were living out in the burbs.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And Reed would take off in a Fantastic Car to go to work, and she'd stay home
wearing
with Franklin.
His pork pie hat and his pipe.
Yeah, exactly. And then all of a sudden, right behind him, a Quinjet would land, and the porn music would start, and you'd hear Hulk Tender.
Oh no. Oh no. Again, I'm the best at what I do, and what I do is infidelity.
That's right. What do I care? I'm older than time.
By the way, I will say this, that Kang the Conqueror has one of the best aliases I've ever seen in comic books. One of the best aliases I've ever seen, and that is Victor Timely. Victor Timely, alias of Kang the Conqueror. So good.
Oh, dear Lord.
All right, does anybody have, we're getting up against it. We got to start wrapping this up. Does anybody have any final thoughts? I think that we've covered a lot, and I've personally learned a lot. The secret societies thing is really interesting. It never dawned on me before that all of these things, you're absolutely right. Cole's mummies in the coal car, an Angela Lansbury mystery, was
well, and the veritable crap ton of California mummies. I mean, who knew?
Isn't a raisin technically a grape mummy? Couldn't that be the California
mummies? Oh, I had never thought about that.
Yeah.
I think Sunday.
I do have a question.
Yeah.
When Cole told me what the topic was, I got very excited because I've got this pet thing that it's more or less a question. But DC has so many great characters that can trace their origins back to Egyptian times. I so badly would love to see someone do a little Elseworlds miniseries called JL Egypt, where there's an Egyptian era version of the Justice League put together. Because you've got Teth back then, Black Adam when he was a good guy still. You've got Shazam. You've got Naboo with the Helm of Fate.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the Orb of Ra. It doesn't have to be Metamorpho, but the Orb of Ra is back there. And here's another good one not to forget, the Golden Age Blue Beetle.
Yes.
The Scarab.
Of course. Yes, I'd forgotten.
Weldon, you are carrying this show. You are carrying this show, Weldon.
That's... And then there's Dr. Fate. I mean, that's a hell of a team.
Right. That is.
Oh, and the Hawks. We almost forgot about the Hawks. I'm telling you, they got a full team.
Yeah.
And they could go up against some really cool characters. Like, you could literally have a play in that situation on existing DC characters in a kind of ancient Egypt way. Like, I immediately, when you were talking about that, I could just see, like, there being a Catwoman who is an acolyte of Bast or Bastet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Who is, you know, among those who are threatening either the way of life in ancient Egypt, threatening the building of the pyramids. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, they were up against the clock building some of these pyramids. Yep. It's like, no sooner did you get seated as pharaoh than they're starting to build your grave or your tomb.
Right.
Because they know they're going to need it.
Well, you
got
to get busy on that.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, and you could even – you've got these characters that have a legitimate, you know, Egyptian background, like you said. The litany builds one of the most amazing superhero teams. It would be a really awesome dynamic. But then you flip that script and you make the Set Batman, right? You make Raw Superman, and that's who they're fighting, or at least that's the referential point. That would be kind of cool.
Oh, you know, and funny you should mention, like, Raw as Superman would be very fitting. Is to have a character that Superman, who is a Kal-El born in our frame of reference. Krypton got the finger, you know, thousands of years before the norm. Right. And it would be kind of like the whole Superman Red Sun and all the other incarnations of the sort of what-if kind of scenarios is, you know, what if Kal-El was adopted by the ancients and possibly even by the prototype of a future secret society?
Oh, the secret society.
How?
So they find the alien child.
Are we going to consider, even at the time period in which we're talking about, including as a villain Felix Faust in this?
Interesting. Not
necessarily Egyptian.
A good one.
But near Egyptian, real near Egyptian.
And I, you know, another
Batman villain that would port in very well is Killer Croc.
Yes.
Oh, of course, is drawing a blank on the crocodile god, but those
Sobek.
Of you
Sobek,
yes. And also it occurred to me that Metamorpho would be an excellent corollary or an analog to Osiris, who was murdered, dismembered, and sent down the Nile, only to be kind of Frankensteined back together again.
Mostly.
Man, this was a good show.
He was missing one vital part.
Yeah, that. Well, you know, some of that. You get a good current going, and
you know, and then somebody finds the Orb of Ra, and you know, oh hey.
But nobody could find that particular piece of Osiris, much to Isis's grin.
I'm just saying that maybe that's what the Orb of Ra was.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
Oh, interesting. It could well be. Or, here, well, kind of, I'm going to get in so much trouble for this.
Oh, no.
But, you know, it could be that, you know, rooting around the bulrush is like, ew, what's this? Oh, look, a baby. And thus...
Two religions
upon the Nile.
Yeah.
Oh, that's Robert Frost interview, Cole. All right. I'm calling it. I'm time of death. We have and then resurrection and then rebirth as we wrap it in linen and bury it for 1,000 years.
A eunuch's rebirth.
Yep. A eunuch's rebirth. That's technically Tom Waits album. What is that?
That was actually the 17th album from our good friends from
Ultron Cafe
overseas.
Has another album.
Ultron Cafe, yeah, it was their 17th album.
They put out 17 albums in a year and a half. That is amazing.
They are prolific.
All right. Cole, why don't you plug us up? We will thank Weldon profusely from the bottom of our hearts, because that was amazing. Like, that was one of
you brought so much to this that we never would have imagined.
This is,
and we didn't even get to talk about Prince Rahman. He was another DC guy.
Oh my god! And Ibis, the sorcerer.
Ibis. Yes, Ibis the Sorcerer.
Yeah, the staff of Ibis, something like that.
Thoron the Sorcerer and Ibis the Invincible.
Ibis the Invincible, that's
right. Ibis was a Fawcett character of Captain Marvel's universe, and Thoron the Sorcerer is a DC. But yeah.
Man, so much. There's
it's a fertile valley, that area, let me tell you.
It's like the Nile when it's, you know, at full flood stage. And
yeah.
And you never know what you'll find on the shore.
The funniest thing about this show, Weldon, is when we were talking before, we're like, this is going to be the hardest show.
Oh, this one was going to be brutal.
Of this story arc. Like, we were not going to be, we were struggling. Are we going to be able to fill this hour? And I bet you we could probably go for another hour if we tested ourselves to do so. But we are not going to do that tonight. We are going to let our listeners not listen to us ramble on for another hour about Egypt, even though we would like to. So, Cole, why don't you go ahead and plug us up, and we will get out of here. And Weldon has been amazing, as usual, because the last time he was on the show, he carried the show as well. Cole and I are just here direct in traffic.
That's right. We're just we get some vague idea, and then we get serious people on board to help us shepherd it through.
Our dick
and of course, you can find us on the not ancient Jedi Cole universe at JediCole.com. You can write to us at JCUmail@yahoo.com. Look for tweets at the Jedi Cole U. And if you're in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, my other podcast, The Rancor Pit, we are only two stops down on the Rancor Pit Roadshow Summer Invasion Tour 2017. Five more stops to go, including, as you're listening to this on, if you're listening to this on Friday the 9th, on the 10th and 11th, we will be at the DFW G.I. Joe and Action Figure Show in Grapevine, Texas. And then we'll also be rounding out the tour. We have in ArlingCon coming up in Arlington, Texas at the UTA campus. And we'll be rounding up our show appearances at Infinicon in August. You can find out about those and all kinds of conventions at Convention Awareness Project Texas at cap-tx.info. And Eddie and I are bouncing all over the place, so be sure and check out the JCU to find out where we are for the Rancor Pit Live, our live podcast.
That's right. And if you like what you hear, go out to iTunes, grab our show, rate and review it. That's how people get us, and that's how people listen. Last but not
least, I honestly don't know how people get us, but
people don't get us. That's how people get to us, and then they're like, I don't get this. But I would be remiss at the end of this if I didn't mention, at least for the benefit of Eddie, there is a great Twinkies comic book out there, Twinkies advertisement for comic books that we will tie back to during our comic book advertisement issue, which we will have sometime in the next 2 years if we can slot it somewhere, called Batman and the Mummy, where Batman fights the mummy over a box of Twinkies. I'm guessing it has something to do with shelf life. I don't know for sure.
Well, see, that's very Bill and Ted, because wasn't like Genghis Khan really keen on Twinkies as well?
Everybody's keen on Twinkies. What are you talking about? That's the whole thing. The caption.
They're the mummy of confectionery foods.
Oh, so true.
I've been around for 2,000 years, and I've never tasted anything so good, the mummy says to a box of Twinkies dead down the barrel of the camera. All right, so buy, collect, and enjoy your comics, ladies and gentlemen. And join us next week when we try to pull the sword out of the stone. No, that's the week after.
Next week,
we climb Mount Olympus.
Indeed. We are returning with part three of Period Pieces, When in Greco-Rome.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. Everybody say goodnight to the lovely people at home.
Good night, lovely people.
Good night.
And we'll talk to you next week for more Hey Kids Comics.